Well, I'm delighted that on a snowy February evening in London, so many people would come out for a lecture on socialism. Socialism is not exactly in fashion these days. When I began as an academic 35 years ago, to be a socialist was to be at the cutting edge of critical and radical thought, and we were taken seriously. Nowadays, to proclaim oneself a socialist and to propose the rethinking of the socialist critique of capitalism, for many people, sounds faintly ridiculous. And if there's one thing, particularly I think when I was younger, but it's still true, if there's one thing that a serious radical academic worries about, it's being viewed as ridiculous, not as a threat, but as an object of sort of quaint humor. And therefore, of course, it is, as I say, literally, it's heartening to me to see so many people coming out. I assume not in the spirit of wanting to see a ridiculous antic, but because you share, in some sense or other, the idea that a recovery of socialist aspirations and a rethinking of what it means to be a socialist critic of capitalism is something that we need in the 21st century. And this is not just a kind of archaeological expedition into the ruins of the 20th. In this paper, what I would like to do is propose a general way of thinking about socialism as an alternative to capitalism. It works off the observation that both socialism and social democracy contain the word social in them. Generally, this term is invoked in a loose and ill-defined way. The suggestion is, in some sort of sense, that the political program should be committed to the broad welfare of society rather than to the narrow interests of particular elites. Sometimes, especially in more radical versions of socialist discourse, something called social ownership is invoked as a contrast to private ownership. But in practice, this generally gets collapsed into some idea of state ownership. And the term social itself ends up doing very little analytical work within the broad political program or the broad critique of capitalism itself. What I will argue is that the social and social democracy and socialism can be used to identify a cluster of principles and visions, a cluster of visions and principles of change that differentiates socialism and social democracy both from the capitalist project of institutional development and from what can be called a purely statist response to capitalism. These principles revolve around what I will call, in the course of this lecture, social empowerment. This, in turn, will suggest a way of thinking about a range of future possibilities for socialism, both as a destination and as a program of change, that generally have not been given a central place within the socialist tradition, but which I think nevertheless represent a kind of submerged current within socialist thought. What I will do then is begin by embedding the problem of understanding socialism within a broader agenda of what I will call emancipatory social science. I will then briefly survey the core criticism of capitalism for the only point of trying to reconceptualize socialism and reinvigorate it as a political project is because of a critique of capitalism. And while it would take us far too long to go in any detail through that critique, I want to just survey the landscape of that critical perspective. I will then turn to the problem of alternatives to capitalism once we have formulated a critique, and again, very briefly touch on the traditional Marxian form of thinking about alternatives, and then turn to my alternative approach to alternatives, namely the problem of socialism as social empowerment. And then we will get to the heart of the matter, which appears as the last part of the talk, but nevertheless is most of what I'll be talking about, which is what I will call pathways to enhancing social empowerment. So first, the problem of emancipatory social science. Emancipatory social science, in its broadest terms, seeks to generate scientific knowledge relevant to the collective project of challenging various forms of human oppression and creating the conditions in which people can live flourishing lives. To call it a form of social science rather than simply social philosophy or social criticism affirms the importance of systematic scientific knowledge about how the world actually works for this task. To call it emancipatory is to identify a central moral purpose in the production of knowledge, the elimination of oppression and the creation of the conditions for human flourishing. And to call it social implies the belief that human emancipation depends upon transformations of the social world and not simply transformations of the inner self. To fulfill this mission, emancipatory social science faces three basic tasks: the task of diagnosis and critique, the task of formulating alternatives, and the task of transformation. Let me just briefly chart out what each of these entails. First, diagnosis and critique. The starting point for building an emancipatory social science is identifying the ways in which social institutions and social structures systematically impose harms on people. It is not enough to show that people suffer in the world in which we live, or that there are enormous inequalities in the extent to which people live flourishing lives. A scientific emancipatory theory must show that the explanation for this suffering and the inequality in the ability to live flourishing lives lies in specific properties of institutions and social structures. The first task of emancipatory social science, therefore, is the diagnosis and critique of the causal processes that generate these harms. The second task of emancipatory social science is to develop coherent, credible theories of alternatives to existing institutions and social structures, alternatives that would eliminate or at least significantly reduce the harms identified through the diagnosis and critique. Social alternatives can be elaborated and evaluated by three different criteria: by their desirability, by their viability, and by their achievability. These are nested in a kind of hierarchy. Not all desirable alternatives are viable, and not all viable alternatives are achievable. The exploration of desirable alternatives without the constraints of viability or achievability is the domain of utopian social theory and much normative political philosophy. Typically, such discussions are institutionally very thin, and the emphasis being on the enunciation of abstract principles rather than actual institutional designs. Thus, for example, the Marxist aphorism to describe communism as a classless society governed by the principle "to each according to need, from each according to ability" is almost silent on the actual institutional arrangements which would make such a principle operative and sustainable. These kinds of discussions are important, for they can indeed contribute much to clarifying our values and strengthening our moral commitment to the arduous business of social change. But purely utopian thinking about alternatives may do little to inform the practical task of institution building or add much credibility to our challenges to existing institutions. And this is why the study of viability is so important. The study of viable alternatives asks of proposals for transforming existing social structures and institutions whether, if implemented, they would actually generate in a sustainable and robust manner the emancipatory consequences that motivated the proposal. A common objection, after all, to radical egalitarian proposals is, "That sounds good on paper, but it'll never work." Indeed, I think for many people, what's wrong with radical egalitarian and democratic alternatives, with the proposals, is simply people don't believe they're feasible, that they're viable, that they're workable, not that they would be undesirable if they would work. The exploration of viable alternatives brackets the question of their practical achievability under existing historical conditions. Now, some people might argue, what's the point of talking about some theoretically viable alternative to the world in which we live if it's not strategically achievable? Why should we engage in a discussion of viable alternatives to the world in which we live unless we already know that these viable alternatives, in fact, could be achieved through some strategy of collective action? The response to the skeptic is this, or at least my response to the skeptic is this. There are so many uncertainties and contingencies about the future that we cannot possibly know now what really are the limits of achievable alternatives in the future. Perhaps we can say something about what sorts of changes we can struggle for right now, what kinds of coalitions are formable and unformable in the present, what sorts of political strategies are likely to be effective and ineffective now. But the further we look into the future, the less certain we can be about the limits of what the future holds for achievability. Given this uncertainty about the future, there are two reasons why it is important, I think, to have clear-headed understandings of the range of viable alternatives to the world in which we live. Alternatives which, if implemented, would stand a chance of being sustainable and accomplishing the goals of which they are meant to serve. There are two arguments I would give. First, developing such understandings now makes it more likely that if in the future historical conditions expand the limits of achievable possibility, social forces committed to emancipatory social change will be in a position to formulate practical political strategies to implement the alternative. Viable alternatives are more likely to eventually become achievable alternatives if they are well thought out and understood in advance of their being achievable. Second, the actual limits of what is achievable depend in part upon the beliefs people hold about what sorts of alternatives are viable. This is really a crucial point and fundamental to sociological understandings of the very notion of there being limits of possibility on social change. Social limits of possibility are not independent of our beliefs about possibility. When a physicist argues that there's a limit to the maximum speed at which things can travel, the speed of light, this is meant to be an objective constraint operating independently of our beliefs about speed. Similarly, when a biologist argues that there are certain conditions which must be met or else life is impossible, this is a claim about objective constraints, not simply a claim about our beliefs about such constraints. Of course, both the physicist and the biologist could be wrong, but the claims themselves are about real untransgressible limits of possibility. Claims about social limits of possibility are different from these claims about physics and biological limits, for in the social case, the beliefs people hold about limits systematically affect what is in fact possible. Developing systematic, compelling accounts of viable alternatives to existing institutions and social structures of power and privilege, therefore, I would argue, is one component of the social process through which the social limits on achievable alternatives can themselves be changed. This, however, is no easy task. It's not easy to make a credible argument that another world is possible. People are born into societies that are always already made, and for most people, most of the time, the rules and constraints under which they live their lives seem fixed and given by nature, not something amenable to transformation through human device. Now, one strategy, of course, is just not to worry too much about giving scientifically credible arguments about possibilities for radical social change, but instead to try to create an inspiring vision of a desirable alternative, not worrying about viability, grounded in anger at the injustices of the world in which we live, and infused with hope and passion about human possibility. At times, such charismatic wishful thinking has been a powerful force contributing to the mobilization of people for struggles and sacrifices in the name of unachievable, non-viable alternatives. But it is unlikely that charismatic wishful thinking would form an adequate basis for actually transforming the world in which we live in ways that produce robust, sustainable, emancipatory alternatives. The history of the human struggles for radical social change is filled with heroic victories over existing structures of oppression, followed by the tragic construction of new forms of domination and inequality. The second task of emancipatory social science, therefore, is to develop in as systematic a way as possible a scientifically grounded conception of viable alternative institutions. Finally, developing coherent theories of achievable alternatives is the central task for the practical work of strategies for social change. This turns out to be very difficult, needless to say, both because views about achievability, just as views about viability, are vulnerable to wishful thinking, and because of the high levels of contingency of conditions, both in the present and the future, which affect the prospects for any long-term strategy. In this talk, I want to focus on the viability question, on the formulation and elaboration of viable alternatives to existing institutions and structures. What I will do in the rest of the talk is first quickly review the criticisms of capitalism which set the stage for that exploration of viable alternatives, and then briefly characterize Marx's strategy, since the approach that I'll be pursuing is a kind of counterpoint to the classical Marxian approach. And then we will turn to the question of pathways to social empowerment. So first, a chart of the 10 criticisms, or when I gave this talk once in Ireland, or an earlier version of this talk, I suggested I call this the 10 sins of capitalism. There was a time when probably it wasn't so necessary to review, even in a hurried way, the central criticisms of capitalism, but we live in an era in which there is such a triumphalist sense that capitalism is the only possible form of society, of economic organization, that I think it is helpful to review these criticisms. I will just do them by reading this list. I will avoid the temptation of going into any elaboration, although, of course, in our subsequent discussion, if anyone wants me to elaborate on any of these, I will. When I've tried to just do a hurried elaboration of each, then it expands to engulf the entire lecture. 10 criticisms of capitalism. First, capitalist class relations perpetuate eliminable forms of human suffering. Second, capitalism blocks the universalization of the conditions for human flourishing. While it creates those conditions, it blocks their universalization. Third, capitalism violates liberal principles of social justice, not just radical socialist principles of social justice, but it violates certain principles of social justice that are internal to the logic of liberal principles. Fourth, capitalism perpetuates eliminable deficits in individual freedom and autonomy. Freedom and autonomy are the strong suit of capitalism, yet capitalism itself perpetuates deficits that could be eliminated under alternative social relations. Fifth, capitalism is inefficient in certain crucial respects, not marginal respects, not secondary little noises around the fringes. There are fundamental ways in which capitalism is inefficient. Sixth, capitalism has a systematic bias towards consumerism as a way of organizing production and distribution. It's not neutral with respect to consumerism. It has a systematic and inbuilt bias towards consumerism. Seventh, capitalism is environmentally destructive. Eighth, The ever-expanding reach of the market threatens certain important values. Ninth, capitalism corrodes community. And tenth, capitalism limits democracy. These are all meant to be criticisms of capitalism as such. That is, they're criticisms of certain causal processes that are embedded in the very structures of capitalism. These criticisms do not, however, prejudge the question of whether societies within which capitalism is the form of organization of economic relations, whether such societies can or cannot find institutional solutions to these harms, which would modify capitalism in such a way that you could have a capitalist economy within which non-capitalist institutions neutralized all of these harms. It's conceivable, it's not ruled out by the nature of the criticisms, that you could have capitalism generating these harms and non-capitalist institutions, for example, the state, in a capitalist society, neutralizing them. I would argue that it's not very plausible, for reasons which I won't go into here, that the state could indeed, as an empirical matter, in capitalist societies, effectively neutralize this entire set of criticisms without so transforming the nature of its economic structures that one might question whether it remained capitalist. But I just want to stress that the criticisms themselves don't answer the question what can be done and what perhaps can be done in a society within which capitalism remains the dominant way of organizing economic life. Okay, if you accept these 10 criticisms, then there surely is a problem of concern. These are strong, not marginal criticisms of the consequences of having a particular kind of economic structure, namely capitalist. And the question then is, how can we formulate a theory of alternatives? Alternatives which would either eliminate or significantly mitigate the effects of these harms. Let me first then just briefly review Marx's approach to the question. Marx's approach is certainly the historically most famous and important approach to thinking about alternatives to capitalism, developed around the middle of the 19th century, and it remained the dominant theoretical framework for thinking about alternatives throughout much of the 20th. He proposed an intellectually brilliant, if ultimately unsatisfactory, solution to the problem of specifying the alternative to capitalism in a credible way. And here's basically the logic of his approach. Rather than develop a systematic theoretical model which would demonstrate the possibility of an emancipatory alternative to capitalism, rather than develop such an institutional theory, what Marx proposes is a theory of the long-term impossibility of capitalism itself. His arguments are, I think, familiar. Because of the inner dynamics and contradictions, capitalism destroys its own conditions of possibility. In the long run, capitalism destroys its own conditions of existence. This is, I would argue, a deterministic theory. It's a deterministic theory in the sense that it involves a strong prediction that the contradictions of capitalism destroy the conditions of possibility for capitalism itself. It will become eventually an impossible social order, and therefore some kind of alternative to capitalism is inevitable. Now, what that alternative is another question, but some alternative is inevitable. And thus, the theory of the demise of capitalism, which is a deterministic theory, solves one of the key problems in developing a theory of an emancipatory alternative, namely, you've demonstrated, if that theory is correct, the necessity of some alternative. Capitalism will not last forever. The trick, then, is to make some kind of credible case that a democratic egalitarian alternative, which is broadly, I think, the normative framework within which socialism would be understood, that a democratic egalitarian alternative to capitalism was credible. Here's where I think Marx's theory got especially elegant, for he also proposed that the contradictions which propel capitalism along its self-destructive course simultaneously create historical agents, the working class, which have both an interest and a capacity for transformation, in which an egalitarian democratic alternative would be the optimal alternative for the working class if it could be created. The actual theory of the creation of the alternative then becomes almost purely voluntaristic. It's an almost purely voluntarist theory, based, I think, on the two, I mean, it's not based on the two folk aphorisms, but it can be captured by the two folk aphorisms. Necessity is the parent of invention, and where there's a will, there's a way. While it's a little bit of a caricature, I think that, in essence, Marx's theory of the construction of an alternative, given the demise of capitalism, that is, given that capitalism destroys itself through its own internal logic, the theory of the building of the alternative is necessity is the parent of invention, and where there is a will, there is a way. I don't think that's a satisfactory theory, but I won't here go through the particular critiques of this theory. Many of you will be familiar with them in any case. And rather turn to an alternative approach to the problem. The classical Marxist theory of alternatives to capitalism is anchored, as I've said, in a deterministic theory of a key property of the trajectory of capitalism into the future. Historical materialism, as the theory is called, is essentially a theory of the history of the future. That's its key purpose, to create a projective history of the future. By predicting the basic contours of the future of capitalism, Marx hoped to contribute to the realization of an emancipatory alternative to capitalism. In the absence of a compelling dynamic theory that gives us a convincing account of the destiny of capitalism, an alternative strategy is to shift our efforts from building a theory of the trajectory into the future to building a theory of structural possibilities. Instead of the metaphor of a roadmap guiding us to a known in advance destination, the best we can probably do is to think of the project of emancipatory social change and the project of thinking about alternatives, to think of it more like a voyage of exploration and discovery than a trip in which we have a roadmap with a known in advance destination. We leave the well-known world with a compass that tells us the direction we are moving, and perhaps a GPS device which tells us how far from our point of departure we have traveled, but without a roadmap which lays out the entire route in advance from the point of departure to the final destination. This, of course, has perils. We may encounter chasms which we cannot cross, unforeseen obstacles which force us to move in directions we had not planned. We may have to backtrack and make a new route. There will be moments when we reach high ground with clear views towards the horizon, and this will greatly facilitate our navigation for a while, but other times we will have to pick our way through dense forests and jungle with inadequate technologies, which then motivate us to invent new technologies of social change, which perhaps create artificial high ground in order for us to see further ahead. And in the end, we may discover that there are absolute limits to how far we can move in the hoped-for direction. There may be unbridgeable chasms, not merely chasms we can work ourselves around. While we cannot know in advance how far we can go, we can know if we are moving in the right direction. This approach, this sort of journey metaphor, a journey of discovery, of exploration, retains a strong normative vision of life beyond capitalism, but acknowledges the limitations of our scientific knowledge about the real possibilities of transcending capitalism. But note, this is not the same as embracing the false certainty that there exists untransgressible limits for creating radical democratic egalitarian alternatives. I think our scientific ignorance on this question is profound, both about the limits for emancipatory alternatives, but also the limits for the sustainability of the world in which we live. The absence of solid scientific knowledge limits of possibility applies both to the prospects of radical alternatives and to the permanence of capitalism itself. The key to embarking on such a journey, to use this metaphor, a journey of exploration and discovery, is the usefulness of our navigational device. That's crucial. Without a good navigational device that tells us if we're moving in the right direction, in a direction which enhances the possibilities for emancipatory alternatives, Without such a navigational device, we will just wander around in the forest without, without clear progress. We need to construct what I like to call a socialist compass, a device which gives us principles that tells us if we are moving in the right direction. And this will be the task of the rest of this talk. So let me now turn to the kind of heart of the matter, clarifying the underlying principles that are captured in my notion of taking the social in socialism seriously. Most discussions of socialism build the concept in terms of a binary contrast with capitalism. Capitalism versus socialism. Here I would like to elaborate an alternative approach to specifying the underlying principles of socialism, in which it is contrasted to two alternative forms of economic structure, not one. It is contrasted to both capitalism and what I will call statism. Capitalism, statism, and socialism can be thought of as alternative ways of organizing the power relations through which economic resources are allocated, controlled, and used. The power relations which govern production and distribution. As a first approximation, then, we can define these as follows. Capitalism is an economic structure within which the allocation and use of resources for different social purposes is accomplished through the exercise of economic power. Investments and the control of production are the result of the exercise of economic power by the owners of capital. Capitalism is a system in which the economy is controlled by economic power. Statism is an economic structure within which the allocation and use of resources for different social purposes is accomplished through the exercise of state power. State officials control the investment process and production through some sort of state administrative mechanism. The command and control centralized bureaucratic economies of the former Soviet Union and similar places would be an example of a statist economic structure where the state controls the allocation, use, and use of economic resources for production and distribution. Socialism, then, is an economic structure within which the allocation and use of resources for different social purposes is accomplished through the exercise of what I will call social power. Social power is power rooted in the capacity to mobilize people for cooperative, voluntary, collective actions of various sort in civil society. It implies that civil society should not be viewed simply as an arena of activity, sociability, and communication, which is the typical way that the concept of civil society is used in sociology, but also an arena of real power relations. Social power is contrasted to economic power based on the ownership and control of economic resources, and state power based on the control of rule-making and rule-enforcing capacity over territory. The idea of democracy in these terms can be thought of as a specific way of linking social power to state power. In the ideal of democracy, state power is fully subordinated to and accountable to social power. Democracy is thus inherently a deeply socialist principle. The idea of rule by the people means rule by people not separately as isolated individuals, but rule by the people collectively organized through associations of various sorts. If democracy is the label for the subordination of state power to social power, socialism is the term for the subordination of economic power to social power. In socialism, the control over investment and production is organized through some as yet unspecified set of mechanisms of social empowerment. So far, this is a black box, and it may be an empty box. But the claim is that by socialism we mean an economic structure within which the organization of production, the control over activities within production and the distribution of products is under the control of social power, not economic power or state power. This idea of socialism as rooted in social empowerment or social power is not the conventional way of understanding socialism. Indeed, Many people use the term socialism to describe what I'm calling statism. That's probably the most common definition of socialism, is a state-run economy. This reconceptualization, however, does capture a central moral idea about socialism. Socialism is an economy organized in such a way as to serve the needs and aspirations of ordinary people, not elites. And to do this, the economy must be in some way or other controlled by ordinary people, that is, subordinated to social power. Now, it's important to be clear about the conceptual field that I am mapping here. These are all types of economic structures, but only in capitalism is it the case that economically based power plays the predominant role in determining the use of economic resources. That's a distinctive feature of capitalism. It's a distinctive feature of capitalism, by the way, recognized by Max Weber as being one of the essential features of capitalism, namely that in capitalism and capitalism alone, does economic rationality govern the economy, and does economic power govern the allocation of resources in the economy. In statism and socialism, a form of power distinct from the economy plays the dominant role in allocating economic resources for alternative uses. It is still, of course, the case that in capitalism, state power and the associational power of civil society exist, but they do not play a central role in the direct allocation of economic resources. For each of these three ideal types, capitalism, statism, and socialism, as I've defined them, one can imagine an extreme form in which only one form of power is involved in the allocation of economic resources. In these terms, for example, totalitarianism could be viewed as a form of hyperstatism, in which state power is not simply the primary form of power over economic allocations, but in which economic power and associational power of civil society have largely disappeared. In a pure libertarian capitalism, the state atrophies to a mere night watchman state serving only the purpose of enforcing property rights. And commercial activities penetrate into all corners of civil society, commodifying everything. The exercise of economic power would almost fully explain the allocation and use of resources. Communism, as classically understood in Marxism, is a form of society in which the state has withered away and the economy is fully absorbed into civil society as the free cooperative activity of associated individuals. None of these extreme forms could exist as stable, reproducible forms of social organization. All real societies are, in a sense, hybrids of economic power, state power, and social power. Feasible, sustainable forms of large-scale social organization always involve some kind of reciprocal relations among the three forms of power that I've laid out: economic power, social power, and state power. The question, then, is the relative weight and forms of combination, how they're connected to each other, and in particular, which one, in a sense, anchors or is dominant within the configuration as a whole. All societies, in a sense, therefore, should be thought of as hybrids. All existing capitalist societies contain significant elements of statism, since states everywhere allocate part of the social surplus for various kinds of investments, particularly for public infrastructure, education, and the like. Furthermore, in all capitalist societies, the state removes certain powers from holders of private property. For example, when capitalist states impose regulations on capitalist firms that require health and safety standards in production. Such rules tell owners that even though they own the means of production, they can't use them in certain ways. And that is a form of statist allocation of rights and control over production. The use of the simplified, unmodified expression capitalism to describe an empirical hybrid, therefore, is a shorthand for something like an economic structure within which capitalism is the predominant way of organizing economic activity. Now, the idea, then, of socialism as social empowerment is to think through the possible ways in which social power could be increased in its weight and ramifications for the overall organization of economic activity, to the point where one might be able to say that we live in an economic structure within which Social power is the predominant way of organizing economic activity. So to recapitulate the proposal and then turn to the pathways of social empowerment. The proposal is this, the conceptual proposal. Socialism can be contrasted to capitalism and statism in terms of the principal form of power that shapes economic activity, the production and distribution of goods and services. The greater the degree and forms of social empowerment over the use and control of economic resources and activities, the more we can describe a society and economy as socialist. And the question then, what does this mean in terms of actual institutional designs? And this involves elaborating what I metaphorically referred to as the socialist compass. The socialist compass has three principal directions anchored in each of the three forms of power we have been discussing. First, the social empowerment over the way state power affects economic activity. That's one of the directions of social empowerment, is social empowerment over the state and this, which affects economic activity through the state's role in the economy. Secondly, social empowerment over the way economic power shapes economic activity. And third, social empowerment directly over economic activity. These three directions of social empowerment can be represented in this schematic picture, the multiple pathways of social empowerment. The arrows in this diagram represent the effects of power from one social domain to the other, to another. Thus, for example, the arrow from social power to state power means that power rooted in civil society directly shapes the exercise of state power. What I would now like to do is look at five specific pathways as combinations of these particular arrows. Here's the first one, which I call statist socialism. And my general, just to forecast the overall argument, I'm going to go through five pathways of social empowerment, each of them representing part of that total figure. The argument about socialism as social empowerment is that all of these have to be combined in an unspecified way. I don't know the relative importance of one or another of these roots. I see that as highly contextual. And the issue for both social theory and socialist practice is to keep in mind all of these pathways and the ways in which they are articulated and connected to each other. I will go through them one by one, highlighting specific points. But this is not to suggest that any plausible project of social empowerment could rely on only one or another of these. It's meant to be a notion of multiple pathways combined in a broader project. So first, what I'm calling statist socialism. Social empowerment over the way state power is directly exercised over the economy. In traditional socialist theory, this is the essential route by which popular power, power rooted in the associational activity of civil society, was translated into control over the economy. Namely, popular power was translated into control over the economy through the state. It is for this reason, I think, that this can be called a model of statist socialism. The basic idea was something like this. Political parties are associations formed in civil society with the goal of influencing states. That's what a political party is. It's a collective association formed in civil society in which people join, they become supporters of or members of, with the idea of influencing states. People join them in pursuit of particular objectives, and their power depends in significant ways upon their capacities to mobilize such participation for collective actions of various sorts, ranging from elections to other kinds of collective actions. So if it were the case that a socialist party was deeply connected to the working class through its embeddedness in working class social networks and communities, and democratically accountable through open political process through which it politically represented the working class or some broader coalition, if that were true, then if the socialist party controlled the state and the state controlled the economy, one could argue on a principle of transitivity of control that an empowered civil society controlled the economic system of production and distribution. And this is the vision in this first model. In this vision, economic power as such is marginalized It is not by virtue of actors' direct ownership and control over assets that they have power to organize production. It is by virtue of their collective political organization in civil society and their exercise of state power. Statist socialism of this sort was at the heart of traditional Marxist ideas of revolutionary socialism. The vision, at least on paper, was that the party would be organically connected to the working class and effectively accountable to associated workers, and thus its control over the state would be a mechanism for civil society, understood in class terms, to control the state. This is not, of course, how things turned out, whether because of inherent tendencies of revolutionary party organizations to concentrate power at the top, or because of the terrible constraints of the historical circumstances under which revolutionary attempts at building socialism occurred, for whichever reasons you might choose, whatever potential the Communist Party had to be subordinated to an autonomous civil society was destroyed in the course of the early years of the revolution. By the time the Soviet state consolidated power and launched its concerted efforts at transforming the economy, the party had become a mechanism of state domination, a vehicle for penetrating civil society and controlling economic organizations. The Soviet Union, therefore, became the archetype of authoritarian statism, not statist socialism, even though it did so under the banner of socialism. In effect, the arrow from social empowerment to the state was reversed, and the state became the center of power, and the party became the vehicle for dominating civil society rather than the party the vehicle for representing autonomously formed associations in civil society. Today, few socialists believe that comprehensive statist central planning of the sort attempted in the Soviet Union is a viable structure for realizing the socialist agenda. Nevertheless, I think that statist socialism remains one of the important pathways for social empowerment, not if it replaces all other pathways, but as a component of a broader matrix of possibilities. The state will remain central to the provision of a wide range of public goods, from health to education to public transportation. The central question for socialists, then, is the extent to which these aspects of state provision can be effectively under the control of democratically empowered civil society. In capitalist societies, typically these public goods provided by the state are only weakly subordinated to social power. And indeed, because of the enormous influence of economic power of capitalists on the state, often the state provision of public goods is subordinated much more directly to economic power rather than to civil society power. Many people, I think, will be skeptical about the possibility of enhancing the democratic character of state involvement in the production and distribution of goods and services. The failure of command and control bureaucracies in both the former state socialist economies and in capitalist economies have fueled calls for privatization and marketization of state services, not for their democratization. Britain, of course, has been subjected to such doctrines of privatization and marketization rather than democratization of state services in the recent past. And many people are skeptical that there's any other possibility. This is the central subject of my book with Archon Fung, Deepening Democracy, in which we argue that there are a range of innovative designs for democratic institutions that provide reason to believe that more energetically participatory forms of democratic governance are in fact feasible over the conventional state activities involved in the production of public goods in particular. And this is especially true at the local and regional level. And so a deeper democracy can be combined with certain forms of what we call coordinated decentralization to enable much more socially empowered forms of democratic governance over the production of public goods. To cite just one example of this, the book contains a variety of examples, but to cite just one example, which may be familiar to some of you, the city of Porto Alegre has created, in Brazil, has created a system of participatory budgeting in which neighborhood councils, in which any resident can participate as direct participatory organs of social empowerment, are directly involved in organizing the city budget and deciding city priorities with respect to the crucial issues of building public infrastructure and city-provided public goods, ranging from daycare centers to public housing to pavements and bread-and-butter issues like street lighting. These are organized through a robust bottom-up participatory process which has produced a less corrupt and more efficient allocation of city funds than existed under the previous command and control centralized bureaucratic allocations. Okay, that's the first pathway of social empowerment is statist socialism. The second pathway of social empowerment is social democratic statist regulation. This is perhaps the most familiar of all. Even in the present period of economic deregulation and the triumph of ideologies of the free market, the state is deeply implicated in the regulation of production and distribution in ways that impinge on capitalist economic power. This includes a very wide range of regulations: pollution control, workplace health and safety rules, product safety standards, skill credentialing in labor markets, minimum wages, and so on. All of these involve state power restricting certain powers of owners of capital, and therefore it's a form of state power constraining the operation of economic power, and thereby affecting the nature of allocations and control over production. To the extent that these forms of affirmative state interventions are themselves effectively subordinated to social power, that is, to the extent that these regulations are themselves effectively under democratic control, then this becomes a pathway to social empowerment. Statist regulation of capitalist economic power, however, need not imply significant social empowerment. Again, the issue here is the extent to which and the depth to which the regulatory activities of the state are genuine expressions of democratic empowerment of civil society. In actual capitalist societies, the pattern often looks like this. This is characteristic in the United States, for example, where industries largely control the regulatory bodies which regulate the industries, and therefore the exercise of economic power, either directly in the form of participation in regulatory commissions or indirectly through lobbying power, controls the way in which economic power is itself regulated. The question then, as in the previous discussion of statist socialism, is whether the state's role in the regulating of economic power can itself be more deeply democratized rather than displaced from democracy into various forms of capitalist self-regulation. And one way of doing this is through what's called associational democracy. Associational democracy or associative democracy, two different expressions are used for this, is somewhat less familiar than the previous pathways of social empowerment, but nevertheless is important. It encompasses a wide range of institutional devices through which collective associations in civil society directly participate in various aspects of economic governance, characteristically along with state agencies. Associative democracy can be interpreted as a pathway of social empowerment involving the joint effects of social power and state power on economic power. The most familiar form of this is probably tripartite corporatist arrangements that existed and still exist in some social democratic societies in which organized labor, associations of employers, and the state meet together to bargain over various kinds of economic regulations, especially those involving labor markets and employment relations. But associative democracy can be extended, and in some instances has been extended, to many other domains. For example, watershed councils, in which environmental associations, other civic associations, and government agencies are involved in regulating ecosystems. Or health councils in some countries involving medical associations, community organizations, and public health officials to plan various aspects of healthcare. To the extent that these associations are internally democratic and representative of interests in civil society, and to the extent to which the decision-making processes in which they are engaged are actually empowered and not merely symbolic, then associative democracy can contribute to the process of social empowerment. The fourth route, which I will call social capitalism. Social empowerment over the way economic power of capital is exercised over the economy. Economic power is rooted in the direct control over the allocation, organization, and use of capital of various sorts. Secondary associations in civil society can, through a variety of mechanisms, directly affect the way such economic power is used. For example, unions control large pension funds. These are generally governed by rules of fiduciary responsibility, which severely limit the potential use of those funds for purposes other than providing secure pensions for the beneficiaries. But those rules could be changed. And even without them being changed, unions can exert power over corporations to some extent through the management of such funds. And in certain times and places, that has become an explicit strategy. More ambitiously, for example, Robin Blackburn has proposed a new kind of pension fund funded by what he calls a share levy on corporations, which would enable a broader array of secondary associations in civil society to exert significant influence on patterns of capital accumulation. In the United States in the 1980s, the struggle over divestiture of university endowments from South Africa was an example of a form of social empowerment over economic power, because of the way in which universities controlled large investment pools in that particular targeted case with respect to the struggle against apartheid. In Canada today, the union movement has created a venture capital fund controlled by labor to provide equity startup to firms that satisfy certain social criteria, including, in particular, that they are worker-owned firms. So the use of union-controlled venture capitalist funds to underwrite the capital needs of startup workers' co-ops. These are all examples of ways in which social capitalism could become part of a process of social empowerment. Finally, the social economy. The final route for empowering civil society involves the direct involvement of secondary associations from civil society in organizing various aspects of economic activity, not simply shaping the development of economic power, but directly engaged in various kinds of provision of needs. The social economy constitutes an alternative way of directly organizing economic activity that is distinct from capitalist market production, state-organized production, and household production. Its hallmark is production organized by collectivities directly to satisfy human needs, not subject to the discipline of profit maximization or state technocratic rationality. In capitalist societies, the primary way that production in the social economy is financed is through charitable donations. This is one of the reasons that such activities are often primarily organized by churches, for example. An alternative would be for the state, through its capacity to tax, to provide funding for a wide range of socially organized non-market production. This is already common in the arts in many places in the world. And I like to think of the arts and the way in which tax funds get distributed to arts organizations as a form of social empowerment and a form of social economy. The performing arts organizations that receive these funds are typically driven towards the satisfaction of a certain kind of need. They're not profit maximizers, nor are they subordinated to bureaucratic technical rationality. They're needs-oriented providers of a particular kind of artistic performative service. And the state plays the role of distributing resources, but not directly organizing the activity. In Quebec, there is an extensive system of elder care home services organized through producer co-ops and child care services organized through child care co-ops that are funded in this way. The provincial government heavily subsidizes these co-ops and establishes rules that essentially block the entry of for-profit firms into the subsidized social economy sector. The Canadian single-payer healthcare system also has an important element of social economy to it. The Canadian single-payer system is different from the British system. The British system of healthcare in its heyday, perhaps less so today, but in its heyday, was a statist system. It was a state-centered system in which all healthcare workers were state employees, and the state directly engaged in not merely the financing, but the actual provision of the healthcare services through centralized bureaucratic control. The Canadian system is one in which the actual provision of healthcare can be organized in a heterogeneous set of ways, including by civil society-based community associations of various sorts. So you can have a socially empowered form of provision, but in which the funding is provided by a state redistributive mechanism. There's a certain sense in which, therefore, I would say the Canadian system has a higher socialist potential, socialist in the sense of social empowerment, than does a statist system such as the British. It would take less of a transformation in a certain way. I mean, I'm exaggerating the potential, perhaps, for rhetorical purposes here, but a certain kind of change would be easier in Canada than in Britain. For the healthcare system in Canada to become fully vested as a system of social empowerment than in the British case because of the statist centralized bureaucratic control structures which govern the British system of healthcare provision. One of the major obstacles to a dramatic expansion of the social economy is the problem of providing an adequate standard of living for people who work within it. And this was certainly one of the big obstacles in Quebec, for example, to the expansion of elder care, home care services, which is an extremely interesting sector in Quebec. I think quite different from any other place in the world, as far as I know. The big problem was people who wanted to do this couldn't also provide a standard of living for themselves because the elderly that needed the services couldn't afford to pay for it. The social economy subsidies that the state provides, in fact, help solve that. But there's another kind of solution, I think, which is unconditional basic income. Unconditional basic income is a favorite proposal of people engaged in this discussion of alternatives to existing institutions. It's typically defended on grounds of its radical egalitarianism, which I would also support. But I also think of unconditional basic income as a kind of strategy for transferring part of the social surplus from capital accumulation to social accumulation. By reducing the pressure on collective associations in the social economy to provide for the entire standard of living of the producers, imagine what it would do to the social economy of arts production, of theater performing arts, if an unconditional basic income was present so that the arts associations, as they engaged in their productive work, didn't have to worry about the basic standard of living of participants, but only the other costs of production. Make it a much easier task. Basic income, therefore, I consider a social economy proposal, not merely an egalitarian redistributive proposal. If you put all these together, then, you get this configuration of multiple pathways to social empowerment over the economy. All of these proposals have at their core the idea of creating conditions in which active participation and empowerment of people in solving collective problems is enhanced. This challenges the prevailing idea that there are no alternatives to capitalism and representative democracy as we know them. Elaborating institutional proposals for viable alternatives to capitalist relations, however, is meant to be more than just an ideological ploy for challenging fatalism that comes from believing that there is no alternative. These institutional designs can become part of a pragmatic project of social reform within capitalist society. There are many possible capitalisms and many different ways of interjecting non-capitalist principles within social and economic institutions. One crucial issue for people morally committed to a radical egalitarian and democratic notion of social justice is the extent to which it is possible to introduce and sustain significant aspects of emancipatory institutional arrangements within some varieties of capitalism. Although the constraints of power and privilege necessarily make any emancipatory project within capitalism difficult, this does not imply that elements of emancipatory alternatives cannot be prefigured within the contradictory reality of capitalism itself. Envisioning viable socialist principles is thus ultimately part of an active agenda of social change within capitalism, rather than simply a new vision of alternatives to capitalism. And perhaps by embarking on the journey of social empowerment within capitalism with this socialist compass, we will eventually reach a destiny beyond. Thank you very much. And if you're interested in the full text of the book from which this talk is drawn, as I finish chapters, I put them up on the website with the implicit hope that people read it and send me their reactions. So thank you very much. I'm happy to.
Okay.
We will take a few questions that no one at eight. So we are fine with that. But can we take just a few questions? Yes.
You get the impression that the social accountability side of this means very small groups and very small budgets. Does such a system provide for large projects, such as the Big Dig in Boston or Heathrow Terminal 5 or, dare I say, Crossrail in London? Or is there an assumption that the social approach means a move towards small things, as apart from, is there any scope for big projects in this?
Sure. Remember that there are multiple pathways, and some of them work directly through state power, and some of them work through state power affecting economic power. They're not all simply participatory democracy at the point of provision of a service or a production process. The vision, therefore, is of a multiplicity of institutional forms, not one. I think that representative democracy will remain important, and not just direct democracy, and that centralized bureaucracy remains important, not just decentralized participatory forms of administration. The question is how these are connected and the extent to which accountability within each can be rendered more democratic. But yes, I think this has the potential for large scale as well as local. The local has a certain privileged character for a variety of reasons. As a project of social change, I think it has a privileged character because local forms of democratic empowerment enhance ordinary citizen participation and are therefore potentially part of a process of self-transformation, cultural transformation, not just transformation of the institutions themselves, which I think is crucial if this is to have a ratchet-like character of a trajectory of change.
Hi. Eric, I feel as if this is a bit of an AA meeting where I should admit that, you know, I am a Marxist. And it's a nice surrounding where we can actually come out and say some of these things. But first of all, I have to have some disagreement with you. I am a Marxist of old, and it's very nice to be able to say that. But in terms of your deterministic and voluntaristic interpretation of Marx, I have to fundamentally disagree, as you might expect me to, where the subject, the active subject, is everything in Marxist interpretation of these things. But I don't really want to make this sound like an old 70s left-wing get-together. But the other thing, I need to frame it, because basically the active subject is one thing. The other one is the expropriation of the surplus value of the worker is something which didn't come into your 10 criticisms of capitalism, which I would have said Marx would have put number one. But in terms of your radical critique, you say that socialism, in the center of that paragraph we saw, is determined by the capacity to mobilize people to cooperative, voluntary, collective action. Okay. Now, I don't know how long you've been in London this time around, but obviously we've had David Miliband yesterday doing a very interesting speech on localism and voluntarism as the new agenda, So I feel as if your speech, while radical sounding, is profoundly mainstream and has a tendency to reaction. You're almost giving vent to the idea that this is the new direction for the Labour Party, the new Labour, to claim socialism, whereas anybody else out there will know that they gave that up an awful long time ago.
If David Miliband's proposals included real empowerment, that is actually giving the actors the resources to make a difference in their lives through their allocative and productive decisions, if it was real community empowerment, then I think it would be pretty radical, and he'd probably lose his position in the Labour Party. The difference between symbolic and expressive decentralization and participation in social empowerment is big, not nominal. And while I think there's a certain commonality in the rhetoric of some of my pathways, I mean, this is not just about devolution to small-scale community-based action. This is also about centralized coordination and so on. The big difference that I usually find when I talk to people who have that sort of perspective, it has to do with whether real power is being given to ordinary people, in which power means real resources that they can allocate and control. Just a very brief reaction on the active subject. I believe Marx was deterministic about the fate of capitalism because he believed in the active subject. That is, determinism isn't something opposed to the active subject. It's because he had a belief that people were capable of engaging in particular kinds of actions because they were smart, they were energetic, they were creative, they could solve problems. That's what enabled him to make certain predictions about the future. And all that determinism means is that you can make a prediction about the demise of capitalism. He was not just saying, well, it might happen, it might not. He was saying there are laws of motion of capitalism in which capitalism destroys itself. Why? Because of the way people act as active subjects. That's determinism. Determinism couldn't mean anything other than that. It couldn't mean something other than it's by virtue of the kinds of people we are as active agents that we are therefore able to predict, because we're not just sort of random, capricious actors. Okay.
Just a question really on the status of democracy in this sort of conceptualization. I mean, you said at one point that democracy was the active, the people's control of the social power controlling the state, but at the same time there seems to be a slippage saying that any one of these social forms to work requires forms of empowered participatory governance. So I just wonder where or if there's a relative prioritization where the sort of democracy becomes the thing that can make any of this work, and who are the agents for making that work at different locations?
I'm working within what I describe as a three-dimensional view of democracy. So there's three primary forms through which the democratic ideal of rule of the people can be institutionalized. One is direct democracy, of direct empowered participation. The second is representative democracy, where you choose people to represent you. And the third is associational democracy. Now, these three are all needed. They can each of these three forms can exist in a superficial, thin form or a deep and robust form. So the democratic side of this project is one of figuring out the institutional devices for deepening each of them, to have a deep direct, deep representative, and a deep associational democracy. And there's interesting and unexpected things that are happening in the world, even as we live it, let alone the world we might imagine, along each of them. Just if I can describe the British Columbia thing just very briefly, because it's so interesting, and I think it has a certain odd relevance to Britain today. In British Columbia, they recently went through a process of, and are in the midst of a process of constitutional revision to change the electoral rules of the province. But the premier of the province did not trust the parliament of British Columbia to devise the new rules, on the grounds that politicians, including those in his own party, would devise rules to protect their own seats. So what did they do? They went back to an Athenian model and empowered a citizens' assembly of 160 randomly chosen citizens, two from each riding in British Columbia, one man and one woman from each riding, in which their task was, over the course of a year of intensive meetings and education, discussions, public hearings, in which they were well paid, This 160 randomly chosen set of citizens in the Citizens' Assembly had the task of devising a new electoral law, which then would be submitted to the British Columbia electorate as a referendum. I think that's a model for the House of what should replace the House of Lords in Britain. There are two reasons why in a parliamentary democracy you might have a second chamber. One is because you don't trust democracy, and therefore you want to put a brake on it. The other is because you do trust democracy, and there's a problem to be solved that can't be solved just through an ordinary parliamentary party-based electoral system. The British system, of course, historically was, we don't trust democracy, that's why it was the House of Lords. Converting it to a House of Notables, which is more or less what it is today, with Anthony Giddens recently inducted, still makes it a break on democracy. It's a way of solving some problems because you don't actually trust the democratic processes enough. I think a random citizens' assembly as the second chamber solves a representational problem that party politics can't solve, and that the idea of having a two-chamber system with a citizens' assembly with staggered 3 or 4 year terms, well-paid, lots of perks along with it so that people feel, and lots of protections if you are randomly selected for it, your seniority keeps accruing in your previous jobs, et cetera. You know, you can figure out the rules. If you had a random citizens' assembly as the second chamber, you could stratify it in the sampling process, so you could have equal men and women, you could have equal representation of minorities, of immigrants. You could create a people's assembly as the second chamber. I wrote an op-ed piece on this, which I submitted to a bunch of British newspapers, and none of them would publish it. And,
this is and your publisher. You will do
I
this.
And I thought it was a really, I thought this was a really good idea. You know, something should be part of the ongoing debate in Britain, which I came to through the British Columbia example.
Well, I wanted.
Associational democracy is where you have various collective associations that are involved in the exercise of various governance functions. So, for example, environmental groups being part of the management system of ecosystems. Interest groups, but they would have to satisfy various conditions of internal democracy and the like to be participants in the process.
I'm really sorry to interrupt this, but we're meant to clear the hall by 8 o'clock so people can eat. So I'm going to exercise authoritarian statist power and ask you to join me in thanking Eric for a fantastic lecture. Thank you very much.